This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Comedian Hari Kondabolu does not tiptoe around sensitive subjects like race, gender, or politics.
People always say I'm obsessed with race. You're obsessed with race. You're obsessed with racism. You can't be obsessed with race in America. There's racist stuff that happens all the time. You can't be saying that I'm obsessed with race and racism in America is like saying I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning. You know what I mean? It's absurd. I'm not the one who's obsessed. This country is obsessed.
That was Hari Kondabolu from his 2014 album, Waiting for 2042. Kondabolu is a writer and a correspondent for the FX political comedy series Totally Biased. He was at one time. Before his career in comedy took off, however, he worked as an immigrant rights organizer in Seattle. Hari Kondabolu has said that comedy began as a catharsis for dealing with difficult things that hurt the world. He's obviously struck a chord. He attracts large audiences wherever he goes. He's in town for two shows tonight at Chapel Hill's DSI Comedy Theater. But first, he joins us to talk about comedy and to be funny. I just put a lot of pressure.
Right, Hari Kondabolu, welcome
to The State of Things. Great to have you here. I appreciate it. tell us a little bit about this transformation. I mean, you were out there to save the world and then and doing comedy at night, right?
It was my first job out of college. I moved out to Seattle to work at an immigrant rights organization. And comedy was something I always did in high school and in college. Mm-hmm. And I never thought it would be professional because I grew up in New York. And I would do comedy in New York, and it was awful. And you'd have to pay for stage time or bring a bunch of friends to see you do 3 minutes at an open mic. And that's not what I wanted comedy to be. I loved performing and sharing ideas, and it didn't feel like that. But when I moved to Seattle to be an immigrant rights organizer, there was a really young, supportive scene. Lots of course shows and coffee shops at Seattle and bars and alternative venues, theaters. And I really had an audience that like had a large attention span, which let me experiment. And so I did comedy at night, both because I've always loved it and I had the space to do it. But also, I think when you have a job working with immigrants and refugees, people who are victims of workplace discrimination and hate crimes, whose families are being detained and deported, that's a heavy job. And I think comedy gave me, especially at that time, a release.
Yeah, a release, although one wonders how you can even sort of muster the energy to find that,
yeah.
Right? I mean, because it's...
I was in my early 20s is the answer.
Oh, there's the answer. Now, I know you say you're from Queens, but where are you really from?
Oh, that question, right? Born and raised in Queens, New York. My family's from India. But that question, huh? It's always that question. It's funny because that where are you from question around the country, I've learned, has meant, why aren't you white? I don't understand your pigment. But in Queens, it meant something different because we all play the where are you from game. And I would say Indian. I'd ask, a kid who you'd say, oh, it's a white kid. Where are you from? They'd say, oh, my family's from Ireland or Italy. Or you'd get a fraction of some sort, a series of numbers that add up to hopefully one. It's very funny because that's not a game I realize in the rest of the country. I'm a subject to be studied often when I travel the country because when I ask somebody where they're from, they'll say something like, Wilmington. I'm like, no, give me the immigration history. I thought that was the game we're playing. So, it's a very bizarre thing. And as the country gets increasingly more diverse, as the numbers change, maybe that goes with it.
Well, and what that first bit that we played sort of shines a light on is this business of not recognizing. So why are you so obsessed with race? Well, because as a white man, I don't have to be.
Right.
I'm sort of the norm and everything else is. And if you're worried about that, that's your problem.
Right.
The other race. Right.
And also it kind of ignores the fact that this country was built on racism. You can't justify taking other people's land without feeling, well, I have it right, and why do I have it right? And you can't take other people and then bring them over and force them or don't give them rights without the idea of like, well, I have it right and this is what I'm building. So the idea that I'm obsessed with race, I'm obsessed with history and context, and I don't think that's particularly, I think maybe being obsessed with knowledge is a fault, maybe I'm guilty.
Well, and when that getting it right creates norms that ultimately are bigotry, that is also the stuff that you take on. For example, here's you talking about homophobia.
How do people justify homophobia in this country? It's not Adam and Steve. It's Adam and Eve. Look, technically that is true. It was Adam and Eve. But if you remember the story, it was Adam and Eve and a talking serpent. I feel like the talking serpent throws the whole account into question. I don't know how true this is. There's a talking snake involved. Maybe you shouldn't base your values on a Jungle Book type scenario. What would Baloo do?
That's comedian Hari Kondabolu on the Conan O'Brien Show. Hari is going to be performing two shows tonight, DSI Comedy in Chapel Hill. I guess the first show is sold out, but if you want to hang around for later, you've got an opportunity. Obviously, an important topic for you, and it's something that can, you know, make people laugh. I mean, do you work at it? Do you have to sort of struggle with the social justice side and the professional comedian side, the timing, the where to put the verb, and sort of thing?
I mean, yeah, so it's certainly in the sense of, well, for me, it's more like every comedian has to go on stage and fail at some point to figure out how the jokes work, the mechanics of a joke, like where the laughs are. I have the same problems, but I think when I miss my jokes, it comes off as very preachy. Mm. And maybe grating. And fair. I mean, you know, that's the risk when you talk about things that you're passionate about that are social issues. That's just is what's going to happen. So it requires me to really think about where is the joke in this. I can be passionate about an opinion. I have lots of opinions I'm passionate about, the points of view that I like. I know where I stand on it. But if there's no joke, what am I doing? I'm not reading an essay on stage. It has to be funny.
Have you ever hung on to one? I mean, it just you felt so deeply about it.
Oh,
you,
God, yeah.
I keep telling this joke until you get it.
Yes. Oh, God. There have been jokes that I finally gave up because I'm like, there's nothing's going to come out of this. And sometimes you get lucky. I'm like, the solution. Mm. It only took 2 years and thousands of disappointed people around the country before I found the answer. That's the weird thing. That's why when you're going to slip it, because I'm going to do some new material mixed with some old stuff tonight, because that's part of the excitement, because the new material is the stuff that gets you excited. Those are the puzzles you haven't quite solved yet, and you never know which audience that you're going to have such a rapport with where magically something pops out of your mouth, you know? So there's always going to be a few new things. But, like, there's risks with that because if you miss and you take a big swing and you miss, it's hard to recover sometimes. It almost, you know, especially when you're having a great set, it breaks the illusion of invincibility.
Yeah, you know, suddenly.
Like the emperor is not wearing any clothes and there's no way to hide it. So.
You know, this just occurred to me for the very first time in my very long life. Just so often musical performers, right, will go and they'll complain, singer-songwriters, that people only want to hear their greatest hits and they can't break out. But I'm guessing, is it just the opposite for comedians? Or do people really come to hear you do that bit that you did
sometimes,
on Conan O'Brien?
Because sometimes people will bring their friends and they want their friends to hear, like, the bits that they love so much. But, you know, often it's not that. It's often it's like, I want to hear new stuff. I've heard this before. How much – well, you know, people have even, like, wrote things on Facebook or Twitter. What percentage is going to be new? And it's like, I don't know. You saw the last time I was in town. I don't know what percentage is going to be new. And that's just part of it. Sometimes I'm reworking things and sometimes I'll mix in old and new. Sometimes – you know, I'll do another show and it's maybe a bit too close to the last show and I don't know who's going to be in the other. There's going to be mostly people who have not seen me before. That's my assumption. Yeah. And I always try to write as much new stuff as possible. But, you know, I'm not going to, you know, write a new hour every 3 months.
I'm always fascinated by the levels of humor. You can take a look at how people behave and make fun of various kinds of behaviors.
Sure.
We can do kind of demographic jokes and we can do accents and take off on you know, various kinds of identity types and just recreate them. And people laugh, you know, kind of blackface sort of thing, a minstrelsy.
Right.
Then you can get at some of the deeper underlying tensions and sort of how this came about. And then some of the very deep kind of structural stuff. And it seems to me that making that funny is where the real genius lies. I'm going to play a clip now from your album Waiting for 2042 is what I think is an illustration of just that.
People talk a lot about being green, the importance of being environmentally friendly. I don't really know how that works in the capitalist society because I feel like those things don't really work together. And I say this because I was sitting on a plane a couple of years ago. I'm reading the in-flight magazine. The in-flight magazine on this particular plane trip is an environmental issue, right? How to save the planet. So I'm reading about how to save the planet while sitting on a pollution machine that can fly, right? The audacity of that, right? But I'm bored, I'm reading along, and the first article I read is called Top 10 Endangered Places, and here's the first sentence. Climate change and tourism are threatening to destroy these natural wonders. I'm kind of amazed, right, because tourism is clearly in the best interest of the airline industry. Way to take a stand, Delta, right? But then I finish the sentence. Climate change and tourism are threatening to destroy these natural wonders, So you might want to plan a trip now. Before these sites are gone for good.
Comedian Harry Kondabolu from his latest album, Waiting for 2042. And of course, 2042, that's the year when I lose all my privilege.
Right. It's just that simple. It's like Cinderella. Yeah, that's the year when white people will be the minority in this country, according to census figures. So that might be 2045 now, just to ruin the name of my album.
Well, I think once people saw that, once us white people saw that, right, we started procreating like mad. We're not gonna stand for this. But that's the thing that you take on. I mean, this is kind of deep structural stuff, and you find the humor in it. Does it change regionally? Is this stuff funnier in some places than others?
I don't know about. It depends on who's in the audience at any given time, and I don't know. It's not always consistent. You know, sometimes I'll perform in New York, and I'm like, that show didn't go nearly as well as a show in, you know, whatever other city, you know, like in Boston or whatever. And so I don't know. And to be fair, also, I don't perform in the South very often. Like Atlanta, like there's a club there that I'll do regularly. But, you know, I've only performed in North Carolina. Other than Duke last night, I performed at Davidson College once. But that's a very different kind of thing, because you also have dealing with people from all over when it's a university. Right. So I don't know. I don't always know how it's going to play, but sometimes, you know, you have a group of people that follow you online, are very excited you're there. So when you're there, you're exactly what they've been waiting for. It's never, you know, I'm rarely nowadays in a place randomly doing a show as comedian X. So because I'm rarely comedian X, people generally know what they're in for.
There's a reason for having you here. Well, you know, again, getting back to this deep structural stuff, if you try to kind of reason with folks about all of our complicity in this capitalist system, we're all playing. I mean, this is the genius of capitalism, right, is that it doesn't think. It precisely because it doesn't think, it just keeps dynamically kind of incorporating everything. I mean, you make a
You're literally born into the machine as soon as you're, you know, in the hospital and hopefully your parents have health insurance. Because they're paying right into as soon as you're born, you're right into the system.
Right. So there are no outsiders. There's no class. We have no classes, right, in our system, because it's all equitable. Everybody's votes. Well, that's funny, right? And you talk about tolerance. I think that's the other great sort of way in which this machine disguises how it works.
Yes.
You have no complaint against us, you know, Arab citizens of a European country. In fact, we will tolerate your intolerance of our free speech, which means we really never have to investigate the question of equal rights and equal treatment.
Right. The idea of tolerance is a very low bar. I mean, even though sometimes I don't even know if it's enough of a bar. Like what happened with Duke recently in terms of the Muslim prayer call that was supposed to be done, I guess, at the chapel.
Right.
And then there was pressure, I guess, from Billy Graham and those
his son,
folks.
Franklin,
sons,
yeah.
Right. And, you know, for taking funding away from Duke. And, you know, you realize, you know, as much as they call themselves blue devils, it's really about the green, right? Because then they were like, okay, we're done. That's tolerance. That's basic level stuff that didn't. So sometimes I feel like my hope for acceptance and love does feel a bit idealistic when you hear a story like that, where, you know, I've heard Muslim prayer calls like in my grandmother's small town in India, which is a Hindu majority, and it's the most beautiful sound to wake up to. And it's so funny. I wake up to that sound. I'm like, it's the idea of devotion and people waking up for this purpose and just being connected to God and something so beautiful. And I wake up to that, even growing up as a Hindu, doesn't matter. And in this country, you hear that sound, people are like, ah, what's that? They're invading. How is this happening?
Right.
It's like, it's beautiful. What are you talking about? Like, look, a pencil can be an object that can write beautiful things, but it also can poke out an eye. You know, it depends on how that pencil is going to be used. And do we ban pencils?
So. Yeah, well, no, and that a Christian fundamentalist would be the one to say, let us now stop the prayer. I don't want this prayer to go to God.
But then
which God are you worshiping?
And that's why when people say Christians are persecuted, I get like, well, maybe in the Bible or at certain points, but like it couldn't be the other way around. Like no one's saying, enough of that chapel. Get rid of that chapel. That's not going to happen. So, you know, in terms of persecution, like let's actually look at who has power in a situation. And this was so... That was upsetting because I thought what Duke was doing was really, really wonderful, and I hate how that happened.
It ain't over yet. It ain't over yet.
Right.
And it is a complicated question. Money's part of it, but there's a lot of kind of other issues that do. But it's at the moment we hope that it's still in play.
Yeah.
When you perform professionally, I mean, what are your are you hoping that people sort of see things differently? Is that part of why you do what you do?
I mean, no. I think I do what I do because I believe in the things I'm saying, and I want to be an honest performer who shares their points of view while making as many people laugh as possible, right? And that's what the greats do. But I don't go in with an activist message because I think when you start thinking in that way, you dilute yourself into believing you have more power than you do. I'm a performer, and I have a goal in hand, and it's making whoever's in front of me laugh. That's it. If we start thinking about greater messages, you turn into an activist or a politician, and that ruins the purity of the thing. And the ego, I mean, we have enough of it as performers. We're up in front of people, and the love and laughter of friends and family wasn't enough. It's an illness. And so if you compound that with the idea that you are almighty and have control over the masses, it's over. That's not gonna end well.
It's great stuff. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hari Kondabolu's newest comedy album is Waiting for 2042. He's going to be performing twice tonight at Chapel Hill's DSI Comedy Theater. You can get more information at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you for listening. You can go to that website for all of our information. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley, the technical director. Jess Clark is our intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.